Welcome to Preference, an experiment in queer radio, dear listeners. I'm your host, Alan. Thanks for being here. We'll be with you for the next hour. First, I want to thank David, who ran our booth for so long for this program, and welcome Kyle, who's picking up that task for us. Before we get started with that interview, I want to briefly mention my gratitude to the Left Forum for canceling this weekend's talk that was part of their conference. This is a talk that was going to concentrate on how transgender folks are really tools of the pharmaceutical industry now. So I'm glad that they pulled this off. It's one more place where disputes about what free speech consists of, what safety consists of. We're going to touch on that a little bit later in the hour, in the context of what's happening in Portland right now. First, we're going to spend the first half hour talking about the history of ACT UP and AIDS activism in the country and around the world, where ACT UP has been able to touch on healthcare for folks. We have with us Luis Santiago and Bob Litterer. These are folks are calling in, so we welcome them. Bob and Luis, are you on the telephone?
This is Bob. Yes, I am. Thank you for having us.
Certainly. Luis?
This is Luis. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being here. We're going to talk about ACT UP, its 30-year history. There's a conference to mark this. And both of you are participating, as well as a guest, Terry Wilder, who we'll be talking with on the phone a little bit later. Why don't each of you introduce yourselves? Luis, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yes, hi. I was born and raised in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and moved to New York when I was 25. And I was a gay activist in Puerto Rico for a period of time. And when I came to New York, I came in the middle of the AIDS crisis, and eventually I joined ACT UP, and I've been working with ACT UP for a period of time. I am a computer programming as a career, and that's about it.
All right. Thanks, Luis. Bob?
Hi. Yes, I was and still am a leftist activist, and in the 80s got involved in the what was then called the lesbian and gay liberation movement. And when the AIDS crisis hit, it was really clear that I needed to be part of the fight back. And so I got active in ACT UP, stayed for 12 years, and involved in many activist projects. And currently am involved in campaigns to free U.S. political prisoners and other fights against racism.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump right in with the starting point, I think, is the first cases in the U.S. of what came to be called HIV and AIDS appeared in 1981 with the medical industry, let's say, taking their time to figure out what was happening to folks. ACT UP began work in 1987, and I'm wondering if either of you can tell us a little bit about what activism around HIV and AIDS looked like before the creation of ACT UP.
Right. Well, there's a wonderful new book out that addresses that question, among others, Lavender and Red. It's about the history of the lesbian and gay left in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And they point out, the author, she points out that, in fact, there was significant activism against the genocidal policies of the Reagan administration and the pharmaceutical industry, starting as early as 84. There was the first civil disobedience in San Francisco. Then other actions happened, 85, 86 in New York. There were precursor groups to ACT UP. And then ultimately, when ACT UP New York was formed in March of 87, that especially after the March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Rights in the fall of 87, the movement spread nationwide, and at its height had up to 100 chapters in the U.S. and Europe and Latin America.
I just received my copy of Lavender and Red in the mail, so I'm looking forward to having a show on that book and its stories soon, later this year. So we're talking about the founding of ACT UP. What did that look like? This is New York City, really an epicenter, certainly in the United States, for AIDS. What did it look like, this milieu in which ACT UP was founded?
Well, I can start. Maybe Luis can add. I think that you had already the creation of a self-empowered community network of services for people with HIV and AIDS, best known through Gay Men's Health Crisis. But the rising anger level in particularly the gay male community, but also among lesbians, and in the overall Black and Latino communities and the Haitian communities in New York, that the death rate was just being ignored by the larger society. And so, as I said, there were other efforts before ACT UP New York, primarily coming out of the gay community. And then when Larry Kramer made that speech at the LGBT Center, that was the spark that lit what was already very, very dry tinder, ready to be ignited. And in fact, it had been ignited on a smaller level, but now some of the projects that had been created by independent little groups now was magnified and had a focus and just took off.
Is there a sense in which... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't join ACT UP until 1990 when the Latina Caucus was formed.
Mm-hmm.
But I could tell you that what ACT UP brought at the beginning was a very focused, direct action tactics to confront the, in that case, the Reagan administration, but also the research environment to do something about the AIDS epidemic. And that's the period where we had the big action at the Food and Drug Administration, at the National Institute of Health, and several others that were very important, because one of the things that ACT UP had from the beginning was that it had a strong focus on clear demands, and one of those demands was that the community be part of the decision-making process at every level to address this epidemic.
Yeah, and just to add a little, part of what made ACT UP New York so strong, and of course other ACT UPs also, particularly San Francisco, was the really strong experience of lesbians who had prior political experience, unlike a large percentage of the gay men who were new to activism because of this murderous epidemic. But for many lesbians, they had worked in the women's health movement in the 70s and early 80s. Some of them had worked in the anti-war movement, in the feminist movement. And so they understood both in terms of the healthcare system, what was needed in the way of demands, and in terms of tactics and strategy, how you mount successful campaigns and build alliances and coalitions. And so I think one of the reasons that we're doing this conference is that the predominant historical narratives and accounts in books, movies, articles, etc., emphasize the role of gay men and barely mention the critical strategic role of lesbians. And also, as Luis is talking about, the key role, which is really whited out of history, of Latinas, Latinos, and African Americans, who were always there in ACT UP. They were in the numerical minority within the group, but they played an outsized role and made a lot of important accomplishments, which have been largely forgotten in the current day historical accounts.
Is there a sense that ACT UP has struggled with perhaps the face of HIV and AIDS being white, cis, gay men, when to a degree that folks with different identities experiencing HIV and AIDS weren't part of sort of the normative discussion, and that ACT UP Was that one of the stories it was trying to tell, that this was a wider epidemic than people were seeing?
Yeah, if I may say something about that, there Please. Is definitely no doubt that at the beginning this was a mainly white, majority white organization. In fact, the Latino Caucus was formed in 1990 because a group of Latino members decided that they needed to have their own space where they could address the specific issues of the Latino community that we face with the AIDS crisis. And actually, one of the first decisions that we made was to restrict the new structure to only members that were of Latino heritage, which was kind of controversial at the time, but ended up being a good thing. So we were closed caucus. And among the reasons that we decided to do that is because we wanted to alter the dynamics of power within the organization.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it was a majority-white organization, despite the best intentions, it still felt like we were a secondary population, and we wanted a space where Latinos could make their own decisions without having constantly to, for example, explain the background that preceded that decision or that one, you know, in order to get the understanding and support of all other non-Latino members. I think there was an important process of growing among everyone, including the white members of ACT UP, and things got better later on, but there is still a struggle and a conflict even today.
Mm-hmm. Bob, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. Well, I think what Luis just said is a really important lesson for all movements, the queer movement, but also any other social justice movement, that people from oppressed groups in society need to have their own spaces within organizations and need to build power and confront the backward attitudes that pervade all of us, even those of us well-intentioned who come from dominant groups in society. But since I know our time is short and Luis is going to have to go, maybe he could just have a moment to speak about some of the achievements of the Latino Caucus in the years that it existed.
Please, that would be wonderful, Luis.
Okay, well, since it's very little time, I think the very first action we did was we stormed a meeting that's called Somos Uno, We Are One, that is held in Albany. These are business people that go to Albany for lobbying efforts. And the idea was to disrupt the gala event by dressing up, you know, with tuxedos and blending with the guests. And then we started distributing flyers with ACE information. Basically, the purpose was to denounce the lack of response from those at that party and elsewhere to the crisis in the community. You have to understand that this period, it was incredible. People were dropping dead all over our communities, and business, government, even community-based organizations were complete silence. And that event made strong headlines in the Spanish language press. Quickly, to say some of the accomplishments, I think many of the things we have now, the services that are rendered by the city, including the ADAP, the housing services, Medicaid, Medicare, the prevention information, which now almost uniformly is in both in English and Spanish, they owe a lot to this period of the struggle. Now you take for normal that everything is translated or that people go to these communities, but it wasn't like that at the beginning. They were very marginalized. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the last one I could mention is that a lot of people from the Latino Caucus actually joined ranks of other CBOs, like the Itacan Latino Commission on AIDS, and they developed these innovative programs to reach our populations. One of them, for example, is an HIV treatment workshop that is based on a pedagogy of the oppressed Latin American experience. And that kind of thing has had a tremendous impact, although we still face tremendous challenges. The rates are rising, and the rates of infections are rising among young gay men, especially Black and of Hispanic descent.
Mm-hmm. We will, we've talked about that particular topic, and we'll dig into it again here on Preference. Luis, thanks so much. Terry's on the line, so we're going to switch and chat with her. But it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. And Luis is one of the presenters at ACT UP 30, a conference coming up in June. I'm talking with Bob Lederer, and we have Terry Wilder on the telephone. Is that correct?
Yes. Hi. Good evening.
Hi, Terry. Terry is one of the also one of the presenters at Act Up 30. Is that right?
Yes.
Wonderful. We're on Preference and Experiment and Queer Radio. I'm your host, Alan, and we're talking about Act Up 30, this conference. Terry, could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Great. So I'm Terry Wilder. I've been an AIDS activist since 1989 and have mainly done the majority of my work in the southern part of the United States. I'm from Georgia, but moved to New York City in the summer of 2009, but had an internship actually at the Body website, which is a large HIV website, in 2007, and went to my first ACT UP New York meeting that summer. So that was kind of my introduction to being a ACT UP New York member, although had been following ACT UP's work from afar in Georgia. And I'm currently an AIDS activist. I work actually at a hospital in New York City and am the director of HIV education and training there. And I'm also an activist in the myalgic encephalitis community because I actually have that illness.
Thank you, Terry. Do you want to dig into some of your experience with ACT UP over these years then?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Do you want to talk some about your experience with ACT UP over the years?
Oh, sure.
Thanks.
So probably the first thing that I worked on when I joined ACT UP was we had a little bit of a crisis in New York City in particular around HIV prevention. We had not been doing a great deal to encourage people to, and our government to really let people know about biomedical prevention, interventions like post-exposure prophylaxis, which is medication that people can take after a potential exposure. They would take it for 30 days. And then people weren't aware that in July of 2012, the Federal Drug Administration had approved a medication for the use of pre-exposure prophylaxis, which people could take a medication every day prior to an exposure to keep themselves HIV negative. And so there was a lot of concern about that. I happen to have a lot of kind of insider knowledge about our city government and was able to work with the folks in ACT UP and that had just formed FAG, which is not FAG, it's PHG, which was the Prevention of HIV Action Group that was mainly just focusing on prevention. And we were able to do a demonstration in front of the New York City Department of Health. We were able to get a meeting with the newly appointed health commissioner, Dr. Mary Bassett, who interestingly is a former Black Panther, to talk with her about we need to do something about prevention. It's not working. We need prevention messages out there. We need funding pushing these things out. And we were able to get her support, and eventually she appointed Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, an HIV and gay rights kind of physician, to the Bureau of HIV Assistant Commissioner position, and then, wow, really things took off. Funding all of a sudden became available, lots of campaigns. Different programs were funded to make sure that people had access to post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it was pretty amazing. And a lot of that focus on HIV prevention was great. A lot of it was targeted towards men. And a lot of what I do now is really to advocate for people to not forget women, because people often forget women in HIV prevention and care. We, of course, have a long history of women being left out of early clinical trials in the early years of the epidemic, and I don't want that to happen in terms of HIV prevention messages, particularly around PEP and PrEP, because women have a right to know about those interventions as well and request them if they feel like it's appropriate for their lives.
So one of the concerns I have about PrEP prophylaxis is it must be expensive. It must be expensive to take this medication. And so is it really just available, generally speaking, to folks with medical health insurance?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on where you live.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New York State, Medicaid covers PrEP. We also have a PrEP assistance program through the New York State Department of Health that can help folks get access to the medication and also to help cover some of their PrEP-related medical expenses like the labs and medical provider visits. But, you know, the manufacturer of the only FDA-approved drug has a patient assistance program. So there are ways for folks to get it who may not have private insurance or have a healthy bank account.
Sure. My insurance gives me a little update on what they've spent on my care for each year, and the cost of my HIV meds is somewhere around $30,000. So I rely on that.
Yeah, that's expensive.
Yeah, and I rely on insurance from the federal government as well as state coverage care. That's a little bit complicated, but it seems to it seems to work out. So I'm grateful for those. You know, and ACT UP has spent a lot of time and energy focusing on drug prices, cost of drugs, and access.
That's right, and another area that's been shamefully neglected in the histories of ACT UP and the larger AIDS movement that we were part of and remain part of is the tremendous achievements, not only in lowering the price of these drugs and in shaming these companies domestically for their pricing, but internationally. And the whole campaign that ACT UP built a coalition in 1999 that came to be known as Health Gap, Health Global Access Project, that made tremendous change in access in the Global South, whereas before this campaign there was virtually no access except to the wealthy in those countries, and today there's more than 15 million people on treatment around the world. And this is, as I said, not just ACT UP, but a coalition that a particularly strong partner was the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa, which was led by veterans of the anti-apartheid struggle who brought their experience and strategy to bear against the drug companies that actually sued the ANC government because they dared to assert the right to import generic low-cost drugs. And that suit was eventually defeated with the help of this international solidarity movement that ACT UP was a critical partner in. And another campaign that's forgotten, and Terry kind of indirectly alluded to it earlier, about the shameful history of the neglect of women in AIDS research and medical research in general, and also in the defining standards for what constitutes AIDS as a disease, that the conditions most affecting women were completely left out until a three-year campaign led by the Women's Caucus of ACT UP from 89 to 92, which resulted in the CDC changing the definition to include conditions that primarily suffered by women. And later, pressure on the FDA brought new standards, not just for HIV drugs, but drugs in general, that required drugs to be tested in women. And there were many, many other victories along the way. And just one last thing before time is up, is the tremendous work that ACT UP and many groups did on harm reduction and contributing to the legalization of needle exchange by people risking felony convictions for distributing clean needles in the streets. and drawing attention mm-hmm. and getting media coverage and ultimately a criminal trial where they were acquitted that opened the door to a lot of people who had already been doing this work before, but now they had the political support behind them of a much broader community, and eventually shaming the Clinton administration, although they refused to lift the ban on federal funding of needle exchange, they at least were forced to certify that the science supports the important HIV prevention role of needle exchange, and they put the lie to the myth that that this program promotes the use of drugs. So there's been a lot of victories. It took a lot of hard work and intensive campaigns and very broad-based coalitions, but that's the work that continues and that needs to go on so that we save more lives.
Well, thank you to you two and to everybody who's done this work. I want to ask about something, the financial speculation tax. Is this something that ACT UP is pursuing?
Yes, ACT UP has been part of a coalition now for about 7 years. That extends to Europe and a variety of tax justice and environmental and labor unions here in the U.S. that's saying that these exploitive transactions could have just a very, very tiny tax that would raise upwards of $300 billion a year that could be used for health care and particularly AIDS programming, as well as environmental programs and other social needs.
Wonderful. Where can folks go to learn more about the history of ACT UP and activism around HIV and AIDS?
Well, I'd suggest two places, actupny.com and also actupny.org, which is the older archival site, and then on Facebook, ACT UP NY. And that's also where folks can hear about this conference we're having on June 18th, which, mm-hmm. although it's in New York, which I doubt that your listeners can fly out to, we are very much working to live stream it, and if not live stream it, then to have video available afterwards. So folks can take a look at facebook.com/actupny.
Wonderful. And you
said I would also encourage ACT UP New York also has a Twitter page. And I would also encourage people to look at the ACT UP Oral History Project website. And there's a lot of amazing interviews from people who were in ACT UP, are in ACT UP, that gives some really great stories about folks and the work they did and the things that they saw in their activism that maybe you may not hear when you read certain books or see certain documentaries about ACT UP. It gives a nice insight into all the people that were involved and maybe some of the stories that people don't have access to normally.
And Terry, that's a website that's all cataloged on a site?
Yeah, so it's I can Google it really fast.
ActUpOralHistory.org.
Yeah,
wonderful.
And it was a project that was started by Jim Hubbard, who's a filmmaker, and Sarah Schulman, who's a lesbian activist, and I find it great. I teach in New York City at a school of social work, and I often assign some of the oral history interviews to my students so that they kind of hear the stories from the mouth of the people that were really there.
Speaking of Sarah Schulman, very briefly, we recently had a program which was a discussion about Conflict Is Not Abuse, her most recent book, and I believe we're going to schedule a second conversation on just that book. Thank you so much to both of you, Bob Letter, Terry Wilder, activists with ACT UP, organizing around HIV and AIDS issues, both here and globally. Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you.
And thank you, Alan. And solidarity to all of you folks dealing with the aftermath of this brutal racist murders. Our support goes to you.
Thank you very much. We're going to talk a little bit about that from a free speech perspective later in this hour with Red. This is such a pressing issue. around what comes next and who is going to perform that. So we're gonna chat with Red in a bit. We're also going to talk about Art by Tartz, a sex worker art and performance show coming up very soon. Again, Terry and Bob, thanks so much. We are here on Preference. We're going to listen to a little bit of Alcazar, our theme song. Thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to Preference, an experiment in queer radio. Thanks for being here. And thanks to Bob, Terry, and Luis for chatting with us about ACT UP. The conference is ACT UP 30 in New York City. Hopefully we'll get to see video, either live or recorded, of what happens at this great conference. Red, are you on the phone?
I am. I'm right here.
Yeah, welcome back. Did you hear us? We had a mention of Sarah Schulman and her role in creating the ACT UP Oral History Project. Chris, you were on with us in a discussion of Conflict Is Not Abuse, her most recent book, and I believe we've talked about doing another one.
Yeah, I would love to. I actually found somebody else who would defend the book. We were talking yesterday about it and about its applicability to sex worker activism, because we recently in the sex worker community had this giant scandal where it turned out that a white woman had introduced two fake personas. She told everyone they were her friends. And so even though, you know, like, I'm on the Pacific Northwest and I never met them, but I assumed that other people had, and everyone assumed that someone else had met them. But really, these two women of color that we were all talking to were just her. So she was fundraising as them, and it was a big scandal that blew up last week. And so we were talking about Schulman's claim that you can't trust women who claim they've been abused, and how disastrous this whole scenario is for people who find out a dangerous claim, because here's this woman who just pretended to be two women who were assaulted by cops, and she just did it for money. Very scandalous. So Schulman might have half a point there. I don't know.
Well, we'll dig into that. yeah, there's a lot there, including her discussion on Israel and Palestine. She has a book expressing solidarity for Palestinians from a queer perspective.
So
there's a lot there. I'm excited to keep digging into what she's laid out and, you know, what your and other folks' perspectives are on it. Speaking of sex workers and activism, we have Art by Tartz coming up.
Yeah, on the 14th of June, which is a Thursday. It's going to be awesome.
So where is it? Tell us straight up.
It's going to be at the PCC Cascade Student Union. We were going to do it in their auditorium, but there were issues with, like, how to hang the art. And so the student union turned out to be a much more accessible space for all of the art that is coming, which is a lot. I'm not actually sure how we're going to show it all, but we'll figure it out. It's going to be 2 to 3 hours of... I'm not really sure about the performances. They're supposed to amount to an hour, but people tend to run over. So of sex worker art and performance art, and it's all kinds of art. I'm really excited about this year. We have a miniaturist coming down from Seattle. She made a tiny miniature strip club down to tiny, tiny little dollar bills. And what else is there? Jack the Stripper has some stuff that she sent, and she's currently the most famous person in the lineup because, you know, she's toured a lot, and she has those two books, The Beaver Show, which is a memoir, and then this new book, Striptastic, which is a celebration of strippers, basically little comics that take a stripper's eye view of the world. It's pretty funny. I'm going to get it for my dad, actually. So that lets you know how accessible it is.
This is the third year. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really glad we reached three years. I feel like that's, you know, now we're established. We're real. Anything below three is not real. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to get an actual family space in my home month next year. But yeah, it's been a challenge. You know, a lot of people don't want anything to do with sex workers in general, let alone their art. Even though the art is not all graphic, I think that my art is the most graphic in the show. Because I do try to take like a hooker's eye view of clients. Mm-hmm. There's some penises and pubes visible, but you know, we'll see how it goes. I think it's going to be really fun.
So that's Art by Tarts, June 14th. I think the first time that you joined us on Preference and Experiment Queer Radio was to talk about proposed state legislation around trafficking.
Oh, yeah, that could be. I think for 4082, I assume. The one that expanded the definition of trafficking to include trading sex for food or shelter, which I had problems with for a number of reasons, mainly that most of my clients, I work with houseless people, you know, if they're deciding to trade sex for food or shelter, it's because they desperately need it, and it's not because they're being trafficked. And so, you know, and there's also a conflict in narratives here. Like, we hear that there are hundreds of thousands of dollars being made off of trafficked youth every year, and that it's a million-dollar, billion-dollar industry. And then traffickers are also forcing people to trade sex for things that the traffickers can't possibly benefit from, you know? So when I testified against it, my argument was that it was simply another excuse for racial profiling, which the cops already do when they arrest sex workers. Like, you know, I saw the deputy DA, J.R. Ujifusa, give a presentation where he said that the things that they look for are fake fingernails, weaves, hair weaves, presents on 82nd, Sandy, and I think St. John's. Those are all known, you know, street worker areas, you know, where women on the street are working and, you know, working out of cars. And that's just, you know, that's the vulnerable population of sex workers. So arresting them isn't helping anybody, but giving them food or shelter or money for food or shelter certainly is helping them. So, but, you know, that would cost money. And that was the big thing. Changing the law last year was free. So
how did that turn out on that particular bill? Expanding the definition of trafficking?
Oh, it passed, yeah.
Okay. We have a guest in the studio.
Awesome.
Welcome, Kat.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so glad you made it.
Yep, I'm here.
Yay. So tell me about your art for the art show, because I haven't even asked.
My art for the art show? Well, yeah. I will say that there's a lot more interesting people in the upcoming Sex Worker Art Show, which is June 15th at the Killingsworth Cascade Campus Student Union Building, PCC. But I do have two pieces in the show, one of which is sort of an abstract painting that is just sort of similar to a lot of other stuff I've done, and then the other one, which is a large graphic. But interestingly enough, it's actually not inspired specifically by sex work, and that's something that I think is really, really cool about this specific art show and the work that I have seen from the people that are submitting is that while everyone in the art show is a sex worker, we are not necessarily totally, totally focused on that experience because we are more than just sex workers. Well, that is our career. And for me, I know that my art really has nothing to do with that, minus the fact that that experience, like any experience I have, has shaped me. So that's one thing that I think will surprise people is you come out to the sex worker art show or the sex worker art party, quote unquote, and you think that you're going to be seeing things speaking always to ideas behind sex work when in fact we have so many incredible artists. We have someone who's going to be singing opera. We have a comedian who talks about their experience stripping. We have an incredible musician artist, Fannie Mae Beasy, who's from Atlanta.
Atlanta?
Yeah, from Atlanta, and they were up here recently. So I think that it will be, we also have some slam poetry, and painting, multimedia art. It's going to be really awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a big goal of ours, to not just, I mean, for one, to not just represent the white cis sex worker, because we're overrepresented. And so we really went out of our way to try and get the more underrepresented, but actually larger population of sex workers who are, you know, women of color, trans women of color, and to get them involved somehow. And then also, you know, art that isn't about sex work, because that's not just what our lives are about. That's like how we pay for our lives, but there's so much more than sex work to it. So yeah, it's pretty exciting to see all the different things, even though my personal art is about sex work.
We're here on Preference and Experiment and Queer Radio. We're talking with Kat and Red about June 14th's Art by Tarts, happening at PCC Cascade. You, Red, also put together Working It.
Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah, and the current issue, I've been in school since winter term, trying to build a career out of the industry. So the current issue is very belated, but it's really fun. I try and hustle sex workers from all over the world, again, to just give me their art and their writing. I can pay a minimum, but since I also don't keep any of the rights, I feel like it's a kind of fair deal. I pay $25 per submission. And so it's basically to showcase sex worker voices. I do really minimal editing. I try to keep people's voices intact. And there are some amazing, like, grotesque, horrifying stories, as well as some really wonderful ones and depressing ones, because it's all kinds of experiences. You know, just like with anything, there's a huge gamut of experiences. And mm-hmm. so every issue is very different.
Mm-hmm. Kat points out that I have the date wrong. It's June 15th for Art by Tarts at PCC Cascade.
Oh, golly. And that's probably my fault. Time is a construct.
But everybody has to agree on what that construct is for it to work.
Very true.
Do you want to switch focus here, Red?
I
think I'm going to let you lead us into a different discussion.
Okay. Well, I mean, since before the attacks, actually, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what the limits of free speech are when it comes to white supremacist violence. I started thinking about it when I saw the reaction to that food cart, the two women who went to New Mexico to take, like, little old Abuelita's recipes and then came back here to make money off of it. Kat, do you know about this?
Yeah, I have heard about it, but I think that it's not maybe the most important thing to be talking about in the current climate. I mean, not to be that person, but white people steal stuff all the time. So for me, I was sort of like, yeah, all right. Especially being Latinx and being Chicanx and being first generation. My father's from Mexico. I was like, oh, okay, well,
yeah, there it goes. I just want to use it as like a jumping off point, because the response seemed to be to dig in and be like, no, there's no such thing as racism. Racism isn't real. And so then, you know, Friday happens and people are still Friday's murders were clearly like a response to white supremacy and from white supremacy. And people are still defending violent, threatening, genocidal speech as free speech. And I just don't think that you can defend that speech as free speech anymore. It's not free. The cost is in human lives at this point. So, yeah, if anyone wants to talk about that, I'm feeling very passionate about it right now.
I'm struggling, I think, because it's such an overwhelming incident. I mean, I don't think I need to describe it for anyone. And we're faced with a scheduled protest on June 4th. So we're not given, and this is by, I don't think I know the language specifically, but what I understand is that this protest is on federal property in the city, and it's...
And it's actually the first of two protests that within that, like, 6-day period. There's one on the 4th and one on the 10th.
And these are both organized by and for white nationalists, is that right?
Yeah.
So we don't get a lot of we don't get a lot of time in between, you know, last week and these upcoming protests. We don't get a lot of time to sort out what our response is as a community or our sub-communities. You know, we sort of need to do it quickly. And so there's a lot of tension, a lot of different ideas sort of being thrown at one another. Do you want to speak to that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I want to first comment and say that if anybody out there is interested in donating to the girls who survived Portland's Max attack, Lydia Grijalava has put together a YouCaring site where you can donate directly to those families. And it is going to be on Lydia's Facebook or at YouCaring.com under Girls Who Survived Portland's Max Attack Fundraiser. So far, they have raised just over $35,000 from 1,070 donors. The goal is $50,000, and I think we can definitely do that as a community. Think about all the people that are out there. If 20,000 people, it means 10,000 people donate $2. You know, mm-hmm. this is something that could really assist these young women in being able to heal, and it is important to support each other in that. Sort of moving on from that to the comment about the white nationalists organizing, I honestly feel very overwhelmed right now with this, and I'm not sure. I really wish that I had more of a structure, but honestly, like, as a woman of color, I'm, like, tired. I'm so tired.
Yeah.
I just feel at a loss, and obviously I think that it is important to wake up every morning and to keep fighting and to, like, take up space when I can, but there just seems to be more violence and more death and well-meaning people in the liberal community that could be helping but just are not coming through for their community members that are people of color, that are trans people, that are queer people. And it's so frustrating because I think I can only say so many times, you know, this is how you can help us. You can listen. Organizer Margaret Jacobson actually recently said, you know, you have to start listening to us and what we need. But if they're not going to do it, I just get to the point where I'm like, all right, well, then you're not going to do it. And I don't know where that leaves me.
Well, because it's not your problem. It's a white problem. And all I see is
But it is my problem because it's like my body and my people's bodies and my family's bodies and my family who is worried about deportation and my brothers and my sisters, both literal and figurative, that are living in fear constantly every day, that are the same people whose doctors oftentimes invalidate them, who come from communities that don't talk about what it is to feel anxious and how that is oftentimes a system of these like systematic violence and oppression. And it frustrates me even more because, you know that I'm probably going to get a little bit of flack for saying this, but the white supremacists and nationalists that scare me the most are not necessarily the ones that have the flags that are out there, but, you know, that are at these rallies. They're the ones that are in our government. They're the ones in police uniforms. There's the ones in the White House. And those are the ones who who terrify me, because at least I get a heads up when it's like a guy that has, you know,
a Confederate flag.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I know. But when it's someone who was elected in office to protect me and to serve me, and I am so sure that being around them is putting my life on the line to the point that I will refuse to call the police, even if I have something like a home invasion happen, that's terrifying. And I don't know what the answer is to that, because I feel like I'm like, overthrow capitalism, you know, it's like really where I want to go. But
in the meantime,
a sex worker, I benefit off capitalism as well. So there is no good answer that I can come up with. If anyone has an answer, go ahead and drop me a line, because I've been looking. And, you know, if everyone just goes out and punches one Nazi, I think that that's a great place to start. Sometimes violence is the answer.
Sometimes it is.
No one quote me on that if you do anything.
No.
Be like, that woman on the radio said, I'll be like, oh, what are you talking about?
Say the white woman said it. Blame it and blame me.
Red said it.
It just feels like there's a collective failure to come forth right now, because the stakes are so much higher than than just protest, it seems like, at this point. Like, it seems like so close to these murders, there are lives on the line, and that's what's being ignored in the free speech debate, is that it's actually not safe. You know, like, it's really not safe, and we have no reason to believe that the police will protect, you know, counter-protesters or people of color. The police have known this man was violent for a long time.
They are the police. You know, I mean, police's families and, I mean, officers and stuff are probably...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to say that that's all people, and I know that there are, I'm sure, are many people listening who have families that are police officers, and, you know, that's,
you
that's
not
that,
all police.
But, because I don't, police. I mean, it is public radio, but that being said, like, it's just really disheartening to me, to say the least. I'm like, okay, well.
Well, yeah. Also, did you see the video? They let him drink a beer before they arrested him.
Mm-hmm. I do want to stop in for a second and note that this is not public radio. It's not affiliated with
public radio.
It's not. We're not affiliated with government funding, specifically.
Oh.
We are run by our volunteers and our staff, and we're funded by you, the community. That's who people are.
People like you.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're interested, if anybody is interested, if you're interested in becoming a member or making a donation, head to kboo.fm and you can do that and become one of our members or a supporter, and help make community radio an ongoing project in our community.
So we can say stuff like this because it's so important. It really is. And I am embarrassed that I've been on here several times and was not aware. But now I know, so I can also donate to keep hearing my own voice. No, just kidding.
So, you know, I have this pretty idea in my head, this fantasy that folks will stand up to these white nationalists by actually surrounding the square where these protests are, and just not let them in and force the government to make a decision. You know, just say, are you going to bust through our lines? If that's what you really want to do, to nurture, you know, the ability of these folks to organize, not only collectively, but in public. But, you know, that's just my fantasy about what people would do to put their safety on the line to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just don't know. Like, I will be there, but I don't know how many other people will be there. And it's a matter of collective power, you know? Like, we need a certain amount for velocity before it actually matters. Because if there's just, like, 5 people or 50 people, like, it doesn't, you know, we're not going to be able to get them out or whatever the eventual plan is.
I definitely want to take a second, too, when we're speaking of standing up for the right thing and protecting our more people more marginalized than ourselves, take a moment of silence to remember the 2 young men who lost their lives, as well as the 1 young man who was severely injured on that MAX train, standing up for the young women. Because, you know, when we do talk about what does it take to come out and protest, well, just last week people died because they did the right thing, and the amount of bravery that took, and the amount of respect that I have for those individuals, and I think so many people feel that way, is really just, like, truly and deeply. So let's take a just short moment of silence to honor those individuals.
Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
Red, what would you like to see happen next? And then, Kat, I'm gonna bounce that question out of you.
In terms of discussion?
No, we're almost out. The hour's almost over. If you have a sense of where our community needs to go with this, and then, Kat, I'm gonna turn that over to you next.
I really think that white people need to start stepping up, and, like, I see people being like, "No, I'm not racist, and we're white people." You know, the best we can hope for is that after, like, a lifetime of working really hard to unlearn racism, and, I don't know, by the grace of God, we can eventually create a world where white supremacy and whiteness is not a construct, and you know, but until then, until that world, like, we're racist, you know, we can't help but be racist. We benefit from white supremacy in every way. And our whiteness blinds you to microaggressions that hurt people you love, even if you don't need to. So, like, I just want white people to sit with that discomfort. You're racist, you know? You can hope to unlearn racism, but you're probably not going to unlearn racism if you're not racist. Like, mm-hmm. Be humble and listen. Please, white people, please, just be humble and people of color.
Kat?
Yeah. So here's the thing. Right now, we live in a country where the government values the lives of white people, specifically cis, straight white people, more than any other lives. And there's so much to be said about functioning within a system when you're trying to fight it. So what I'm telling you, if you're a listener, if you're a white cis person that identifies as being a liberal that wants to show up for the communities of people of color, trans people, and queer people on June 4th, I'm telling you, the media will freak out if a cop hits a cis straight white dude. They'll freak out. If it's a white, cis, straight soccer mom, they probably will not meet us with the same violence as if it was the bodies of people of color. So if you care about us, if you care about our community, I am asking you to show up to the square on June 4th and put your body where your mouth has been, because you have the power to protect people in your community, and I want to see you do it. And if you're not there, then you need to sit down with yourself and understand why it is. And if it's because you're scared, I need you to take a second and understand that that fear is what so many people of color and trans people and queer people feel every single day of their lives. So what are we worth to you? That's the real question. What are we worth to you, Portland?
Kat, thank you so much. And Red, thank you as well. I'm grateful,
too. Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Hard Knock Radio is up next. I'm Alan, your host. This is Preference and Experiment in Queer Radio, and we will return in 2 weeks. We'll see what that show is.
Awesome.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.